The weather in the news with massive hurricanes, tornadoes, floods, blizzards becoming more frequent. Locally, we've had a very cold and snowy February and March and April. But at other times, temperatures are above normal for long periods of time. How does that affect trees and the forests we live in? Climate change on a local level will be the topic on Earth Day, April 22nd at Chucker Auditorium at Itasca Community College. From 6:30 until 7:30, research ecologist from the USDA Forest Service, Brian Palick, will talk about the effects of the climate change on local forests. Refreshments are at 6. It's free and open to the public. It's sponsored by the local chapters of the Isaac Walton League, the Society of American Foresters, Earth Circle, and the ICC Natural Resources Club. Brian, thanks for joining us this morning. Always a happy day to see you in the studios. So, how are our recent climate events going to affect our forests?
Well, thanks, John. Thanks for having me here. So, as you can imagine, nationwide and beyond, forestry research is really geared towards understanding climate change. And it's a big focus of that is on adaptation of forests to what's likely to change. And one of the immediate changes is our average annual temperature has definitely increased since the early 1970s or so. And here in Grand Rapids, we've had about a 5 degree Fahrenheit average annual temperature increase. So that's one of the immediate things that we know has happened. And plants, trees included, respond differently than to that warmer average temperature, including growing season temperatures, than they have in the past. So we're seeing some changes in how our local flora, our local tree community responds to that temperature change.
Now, my experience has been that most of that temperature change hasn't been elevated summer temperatures, but more less cold in the winter. And that portends some things that I think there was a lot of discussion this winter when we finally made minus 40 for the first time in, 14 or 15 years. But the effects of that on forest pests must be something you're considering as well.
Exactly. So there's a lot of concern about how both native pests as well as new pests, novel pests, both insect and disease, are responding to warmer winters in particular. Yes, this was not a good year to be thinking about warmer winters, but I'm just looking at our climate data for March, and it's 5 degrees below the 30-year average for mean temperatures, maxes and mins for March. So you look at that and say, how can it be warming? Well, it's really, organisms in the forest respond to a longer-term trend than what happens year to year. So in answering that question, there is a concern that there's going to be much less overwinter mortality of pests, particularly insects, and then related to that warming temperature, and that we're going to see more frequent outbreaks and larger outbreaks of pests.
Brian, this is Harry Hutchins, and I wondered about the flowering and some of those reproductive things that trees and shrubs have to do. I would think that that has to have an impact by this change of climate. Maybe it's they're surviving better or they're producing. I don't know. What have you looked at that at all?
So that's a good question here. As John knows, the phenology of our local plants, our local flora, are really important in terms of how those trees and other plants reproduce, how they produce flowers, how they produce seed, how the early phases, the seedling phases, survive or not. We don't work on that aspect of climate change specifically, but certainly it is both in the state and nationwide and internationally an area of interest and concern that those changes in temperature cues and triggers are going to really radically change how plants reproduce. And we haven't seen sort of the outcome of that yet, but it is a concern.
All these insults that come about, the insect pests and the cold weather and the not cold weather, what what overall effect may that have on our forest compositions? Will we see a change? Are we anticipating a change?
We are anticipating a change, John, and changes in habitat suitability are probably one of the early things we're going to see. In fact, we've already seen it. You think about plant hardiness zones in the state. Zone 5 really didn't used to exist in Minnesota at all, and it's about half of the state now, a third of the state.
Really? It's that?
Zone 2 was a pretty large hardiness zone in northern Minnesota in the 90s. It doesn't exist in Minnesota anymore. So when you think about it, gardeners get this. They know what they're looking for in terms of hardiness zones. It's the same with our forest plants and our trees. We really have habitat suitability for our southern Minnesota tree species here now, and we have for maybe 10 years or so. For example, true white oak, Quercus alba, we can grow it here now. In fact, we are on a large-scale basis on the Chippewa National Forest. So it is going to change our composition, and in fact, it already is when you think about those shifts in habitat.
So you're growing the true white oak up here in northern Minnesota?
We are, John. So
is this a designed program?
It is designed. So the Chippewa National Forest I have an installation of an experiment called Adaptive Silviculture for Climate Change. It's really looking at how to adapt our important local forest types to what's likely to happen by the end of the century. Our installation is the first in a national network across the country in different forest types. And we have it in red pine-dominated forest on the Cutfoot Experimental Forest. And it's big scale. It was the largest timber harvest in the history of the national forest involved and the largest planting effort, inclusive of a number of southern species, southern Minnesota species. So true white oak, bitternut hickory, black cherry are planted on a large scale in this work.
Now, are you, when you prep a site for that, are you clear cutting? Are you doing experiments with thinning and planting? How's that all going?
It's really more a combination of, it's not clear cutting by any means. The National Forest and a very few forest management organizations clear cut anymore. There's always some level of retention of the intact forest left behind. So what we've done on that experiment is create a range of establishment conditions across the stands, from more open, more light, to more shaded, and then we planted an array of species that we're looking at how they're responding to that variability in condition and growing conditions.
How long has this been going on?
The experiment's been on the ground about 5 years now, but it's really starting to come on its own. The seedlings that we planted are 3 years old now. This is the fourth growing season going into.
So you're going to plant redbud then?
We certainly looked at redbud, Harry. We looked at, believe it or not, eastern red cedar as a potential conifer replacement. But we settled on, and this will seem a little bit odd at first mention, on ponderosa pine as a potential replacement for red pine, both economically, ecologically, and culturally, in terms of what a pine that's likely to do well under the conditions that are predicted for the end of the century. So we have a large planting of ponderosa pine under red pine in red pine forest.
That whole statement implies that the red pine might be a loser. Who are the losers?
The losers are the boreal tree species or the near boreal tree species. So our aspens, paper birch, white spruce, balsam fir, red pine to some extent. It depends on the model the climate change scenario that you look at. Really, our approach and our thinking is to hedge our bets and put a variety of different adaptation approaches out there on the landscape, including working. The first line of defense is always working with your native species and managing for diversity of tree species. Harry knows this. I'm sure he drilled it into his
students. He's tried to teach me that, too, but so far.
And the idea is that there's something in that mix that's going to respond well to climate change. So you always want to start with what you have. Northern red oak, bur oak, red maple, for example. Eastern white pine should do well under the current predictions.
And we got, some of these species like eastern white pine have a tremendous range. I mean, Georgia up here and farther north. But so something like that, you know, are you going for the southern genetic mixes and trying to see if they do better, like instead of using eastern white pine here?
That's right, Harry. So you've hit the nail on the head. It's really those species that have large geographic range, particularly the ones that the range is trending south from us, that have the genetic adaptability to be moving into the projected future climate that we have up north here. Whereas the boreal species were on the southern edge of their range, their habitat is moving north out of our area. So eastern white pine is an example of that. On our work, we've actually taken seed sources from the next southern climate zone in Minnesota for our true white oak, for our hickory, for our white pine, and those are what we planted here.
I was going to ask that question. So you're taking seed sources that are already sort of at the northern edge of their range and bringing them further north.
Exactly, John, yes.
Okay. I've got another question, maybe totally unrelated, but I noticed over the past several years that we've had ice storms, and I don't recall a lot of ice storms in the past, and I know that white pines don't like ice or heavy wet snow. They shed branches. I know that birches, when you put them in an ice situation, they don't respond well. Is that type of a climate effect going to affect the forest as well?
I think so, John. So there is concern that these sort of catastrophic pulse weather events are going to become more common and more frequent. And there's evidence that they have, like ice storms. You've been watching this a long time. And so your observation that we didn't used to have them like we do now is probably spot on. And it has to do with more precipitation in the winter, in whatever form, and just cold enough to freeze it. And as you said, our native tree species really aren't well adapted to that kind of disturbance. So I think that the potential for more of that is a concern. And really what those kinds of disturbances do, the immediate damage to the forest is obvious. The branches breaking, the trees breaking, and so on. But they create sort of pulse opportunities for change in the forest. It's really in a after an event like that that you have other species establishing and starting to take over the forest condition. And so that is a general way of thinking about what's likely to happen, is those kind of pulse, unusual pulse disturbances, unusual in that we didn't used to have them, that'll lead to massive changes in our forest.
And now we're having them more frequently.
That's the what it looks like for sure, and that's a prediction as well.
Huh. What are those other species that would take over?
Well, it's some of that I've already talked about, I guess, that are probably adapted to the future. So it could be eastern white pine is legendary in northern Minnesota, and I think it's really good news that that's a species that's predicted to hold its own into the future. Red maple is a species we have here that isn't really particularly of interest to at least the timber industry currently, but it's one that's quite invasive, and that would be one I'd be concerned about that would gain a stronghold after a disturbance like that. It's already here, but it's not here in the abundance that it could be, like in the eastern U.S. where it's much more abundant.
Will we see something like the striped maple? Will that show up here? I don't even know what the range is for the striped maple.
Yeah, we're just on the edge of the range for striped maple now. Here,
yeah. Right? Yeah. And you find it over in the UP, probably more so in the northern lower part of Michigan.
All right. Yeah. And what about hemlock? Is hemlock a winner? Is that something we might see?
Hemlock would be a winner if nothing else was bothering it other than temperature. But there's this insect, the pest that's decimating it. Hemlock woolly adelgid, it's called her strange name.
Right.
That's really probably leading to its potential local extinction.
That's introduced again, right?
That's right. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, and those sorts of things we talked about. Some of the woody adelgid, is that animal or mineral or
it's an insect.
it's an insect. Okay. Yep. Yeah, and that insect, I suppose, is like the others that we're fearing. It needs some seriously cold weather for a seriously long time to wipe it out.
So one that we're facing right now here that falls into that model is emerald ash borer.
Right.
It's in Duluth. It's in Anoka. I believe it was just found in another county somewhat north of the cities last week. Blanking on the name. But the concern is it's heading our way, and we have more ash forest in one contiguous area than anywhere else in the country. 1 million acres, 1 billion trees.
Oh my. I had no idea it was that much.
So it's not just the insect that's the problem, it's that the warmer winters are leading to more survival and faster spread.
What's going to take over for the ash? Because the ash are sort of they're a community that kind of occupies this niche that is not altogether wet and not altogether dry. It's a kind of an interesting forest.
It's quite a concern, and we've been studying it for a while now. Our black ash wetlands that are the dominant feature type of ash in northern Minnesota, there really aren't a lot of other tree species that are abundant enough to readily take over when that tree dies from emerald ash borer. So we've actually have another large-scale experiment on the Chippewa National Forest that we've been looking at. And you get a kick out of this. The species that's doing the best in terms of our transplants is swamp white oak.
Oh.
Which occurs in the Rochester area, southeastern Minnesota is the northern part of its range. But we've moved it up, and it's doing quite well. It's a wetland species, and it does well in that kind of situation. And again, its habitat is here. If you look at hardiness zones, it's been here. The habitat for it is here now.
But it's native down in Rochester and
it is
Houston County and that kind of.
That's right. It's planted pretty extensively on St. John's University campus, if you've ever been there. Most of the parking lot trees are swamp white oak. But in terms of its native range, I've talked with John Almendinger about this, and closest we could get is southeastern Minnesota in terms of where they found it naturally. Okay. But it's here now because we're looking at it as a replacement potential.
Interesting.
Yeah, it fascinates me. What ground level? What are we going to see? You know, for my money, hazelbrush is sort of the buckthorn of northern Minnesota. Not that it's as difficult to to get through, but it's everywhere, and I'm just wondering if it will continue to accelerate its colonization, or will we see something else down below the tree species?
As somebody that had to fight my way through a lot of hazel over the years, I would like to think that maybe it would be reduced, but I suspect that it's actually going to increase in abundance and aggressiveness. And you think about it, it's pretty widespread and abundant in southern Minnesota on drier forest sites, oak forest sites. So I don't think we're going to see a decrease in that. It's funny, though, that the people that study this by modeling in terms of plant responses, shrubs are sort of a less studied component of the forest than the trees are. So perhaps we need to look into that
more. I got to tell you, speaking of hazelbrush, there's nothing like walking behind someone at 20 below zero and having a hazelbrush branch smack you on the cheek. It's like, wow.
What about a hackberry?
Well, hackberry, it's funny you should say that. So we actually have in our wetland forest research, we have transplanted hackberry. The seed source is from southern Minnesota. And it's doing fairly well in terms of its survival and growth. I guess we have 8 years of growing seasons under our belt for hackberry. Again, it's a wetland species. So what we're trying to find is a species that at least can replace black ash in those settings ecologically. Black ash, depending on who you are, who you talk to in the tree, it doesn't have a huge market value in terms of its timber value. It can produce really nice logs, but mostly it's used for pallets and crates. So we're not really looking at a replacement from that standpoint. It's one that will continue to pump water through transpiration in those wet situations. Because what we know is, without trees, wetlands get wetter. And they become very difficult to maintain as trees if you're not keeping a tree component in it. So that's what we're trying to pursue.
And I remember a person that lived on Deer Lake, just right here around Grand Rapids, and he kept saying to me, well, I cut all the darn ash trees, and I'm wondering why the water came up and flooded my grass. And I said, try to explain to him that you don't want to do that.
Yeah, each of those trees is a straw. Sucking water up out of the pond.
I like that.
Exactly.
Are are walnut, butternut, are they in the mix for spreading north? I'm a woodworker, and both of those are desirable species.
What you can assume is any tree species that's native and doing well in southern Minnesota now, by the end of the century for sure, if not earlier with help, should have habitat in northern Minnesota that's suitable. Now, butternut isn't all that far away. There are scattered individuals up here now.
Yeah.
And it's same with black cherry. You know, black cherry is here now, but the habitat suitability is predicted to increase substantially within the next 20 years or so. So, yeah, I would say that they are in the mix.
It's always surprising for me to look at those trees, both the butternut and the black cherry, because I don't see them often enough. But when I do run into them, I'm like, who are you?
Exactly. So my friend and colleague, John Riola, sent me some pictures recently of a large black cherry they milled into some specialty trim, and it's just beautiful. And it's growing on their property, and he's pretty interested in trying to get more of it into the future because they deal with those specialty woods now. And,
sure.
And so he's looking forward to more black cherry.
Yeah, likewise. It's a wonderful wood to work with. Brian, thank you so much for coming in. I can't wait to hear your program on the 22nd at the Chucker Auditorium. You're going to be speaking about this same topic, climate change and its effects on our forests. And that begins at 6:30 on the 22nd at Chucker at ICC here in Grand Rapids.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.